Thank you. Be seated. Justices O'Neill and Brister are recused from the final case, and we are ready to hear argument from petitioners in Shell Oil versus HRM.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Baldwin will present an argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the question on appeal in this case is the proper interpretation of Section 2305 of the Uniform Commercial Code. I have asked the clerk to place before each of you an exhibit for this oral argument, which sets forth the pertinent part of that section. Also on the exhibit is the text of Comment 3, which we submit is the proper interpretation of Section 2305 and the one intended by the drafters. As the court knows, this is a case in which several hundred Shell franchise dealers claimed that Shell had breached its dealer agreements with them by charging a bad faith DTW price for all of the gasoline that each dealer had purchased from Shell. DTW is an acronym in the trade, stands for dealer tank wagon, refers to the price of the gasoline that's delivered in the tank wagon to the station. The dealers allege that Shell's DTW price was in bad faith because some dealers could not compete effectively or had experienced decreased profitability. The damage model asserted was the difference between the dealer tank wagon price and a hypothetical good faith price selected by plaintiff's expert multiplied by every gallon of gasoline that every dealer had purchased throughout the limitations period.
The brief says the DTW price is set without regard to the rack price. Is that true of all of the sellers?
Well, it is true for Shell, Your Honor, and it's my understanding from my exposure to this industry that there is not a lockstep between DTW and rack prices. The trial judge, Honorable Scott Brister, granted summary judgment for Shell. His action was based on a long line of cases in other jurisdictions interpreting Section 2305 in the context of gasoline distribution.
Why would Shell be hurt if it let its dealers buy from jobbers who bought wholesale from you, as long as the dealers had to pay a certain fee for your advertising, branding, goodwill, etc.? They paid a few cents a gallon or whatever it is for that. Why was it so important to you that your jobbers be able to sell to anybody except your own dealers?
Well, Shell jobbers operate mostly in the hinterlands of metropolitan areas, out in the outskirts. They have their own system of support for their stations. Shell has a completely different system of support for its dealer stations in terms of counseling as to marketing, environmental matters, accounting, etc. Shell has a policy that's reflected in its jobber contracts that essentially would require the jobbers to pay the DTW price if they resold in competition with Shell's dealers, if that's responsive.
Why, though?
So that the dealers are not put at a disadvantage.
Why would it put them at a disadvantage?
If they were competing head to head, say, with a jobber supplied station. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's judgment. It chose to follow a recent Fifth Circuit decision called the Mathis case. It's our position that the Fifth Circuit opinion ignored the overwhelming body of case law, ignored the legislative.
At one point, the circuit said, in the absence of comment 3, there's no doubt Exxon would be subject to both the subjective and objective elements of good faith. Do you agree with that part?
I do not. I believe that the Mathis case was the first case that I'm aware of anywhere in the country in which the honesty and factor rubric from the definitional section was used to create a cause of action based solely on specific intent. There's no support for that beyond that.
Does honesty and fact suggest subjective intent? Just the words.
I think that's situational, Your Honor. It certainly doesn't in this case. And there's no case law support to take the honesty.
Are you saying that the honesty and fact test could be subjective in some cases and objective in others?
With all the myriad fact situations that could arise, I really can't say that it would never be. So I guess I would have to say, concede that, you know, on some fact situation. But in the context,
it might be a difficult test to apply, and for
very difficult,
and for people to arrange their business according to, wouldn't it?
That is part of the great problem that the refiners are now having in light of this Mathis decision.
But honesty, in fact, is in the UCC.
It is in the definitional section, Your Honor. But the drafters of Section 2305 were the very same people who drafted the definitional section. They understood that it was there. And the legislative history makes it clear that they did not intend for that language to be a fulcrum to import this subjective intent test into 2305. In fact, all of the legislative history indicates that the drafters meant just the opposite. And the law, pardon me.
Does honesty in fact ordinarily mean subjective intent?
I think honesty in fact is not defined, further defined in the code. There are not a lot of cases that I have seen on what honesty in fact means. They are very fact specific. And I think it becomes very difficult to parse an objective and a subjective test. If someone lies, is that subjective or is it objective? But I am certain that no case has ever used the honesty in fact language prior to Mathis to create a subjective intent test for good faith pricing under Section 2305.
And your objective test is based solely on what's going on in the market among similarly situated competitors.
It is a test that includes being within the range of the dealer prices offered by your major competitors and not price discriminating within a price zone.
Okay. And so if 60% of the industry decided to start charging $5 a gallon to their dealers with the intent that the dealers would all be gone within 2 weeks, then and everybody in the industry does it uniform to all their dealers, then school, that's it. We can't look at that. I mean, maybe you have an antitrust case or some other claim. As far as 2305, that's the end of the inquiry.
There may be many things that we would look at that under, but not 2305. That's what the drafters intended. That is what the overwhelming body of the case law holds. To do otherwise, to accept the Mathis test, puts us into terrible public policy situations, which I'll discuss.
Mr. Baldwin, what courts, if any, have actually foreclosed the possibility? What courts have actually foreclosed the possibility that bad faith be shown by an attempt to run the contracting party out of business?
Your Honor, in our reply brief, we address that directly and cite, and we've been accused of string citing because there are several of them, cases in which that very self-same claim has been made and rejected time and time again as a matter of law. I may miss some because I don't have the reply brief in front of me, but generally the Tomlin case, most recently in the Sixth Circuit, Adger 1 and 2 from the Ninth Circuit, the Wayman case.
So you don't have the other cases you've directed me to. Thank you.
The problem here is that if commercial reasonableness is the only test, following up on the Chief Justice's question, if there were some parallel behavior in the industry so that everybody started moving to a price that was less connected to the rack price, It doesn't seem like it would be appropriate to say that was a good faith open-end price just because the market in which all of the participants were didn't happen to be doing the same thing, let's assume they were, you know, conspiracy, dictated that price.
Well, Your Honor, obviously, if there was a conspiracy of that sort going on, there's all sorts of laws to address that. The drafters of this section were well aware of the definition of good faith. They clearly adopted adopted comment three for the specific purpose of ensuring that sellers under open price term contracts were not subjected to this endless question and litigation about the reasonableness or the fairness of the selling price. And the courts have virtually uniformly followed those decisions.
How long are most of these dealer contracts for? What's the term on most of these dealer contracts?
Your Honor, when I first started dealing with these cases, I saw some that were 5 years. I think that's coming down. I think the ones that I've seen recently are 3 and 2 years.
And are they generally terminable by either party at the end of that time, or are they renewable unless there's good reasons not to?
That gets it's a very complicated question under
the There's nothing standard in the industry? Or is that governed by the federal law?
I think that the answer to that is twofold. It differs from refiner to refiner, but more importantly, there are very significant rules under the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act that deal with non-renewal of a petroleum franchise. So there are circumstances under which the dealer can always walk away. There are circumstances under which the refiner can non-renew a dealer if he complies with federal law, if that's responsible.
Well, I was just trying to get a sense of what the market situation we're in is. In other words, if the nature of the public demand is changing rather radically, and it may be changing just because the nature of automobiles have changed. You don't need to check your oil and check the tires every time you have a fill-up like we did when some of us started driving. But if that nature's changing, how long does law and contracts generally set the current structure in place to make it difficult for either party to change if there is a demand for a different type of market? And how, and I'm trying to get that to help inform me how to look at what the UCC is about.
I hope this is responsive. First, there are significant changes undergoing in the market right now, and I would respectfully refer the court to the ExxonMobil amicus brief. It's a detailed discussion of what's going on in the market. As far as changes in the dealer agreements, again, that's covered by the PMPA. The Petroleum Marketing Practices Act allows changes in the dealer agreements, but imposes a very thoroughgoing scheme of control over what those changes are. So that question is one that we could talk about and back and forth about for a very long period of time. It's not a simple question of look at the term in the agreement. On the record before this court, Shell is entitled to judgment as a matter of law for three separate independent reasons. First, the undisputed evidence conceded by the Court of Appeals demonstrates that Shell's DTW prices were objectively reasonable under the test adopted by the vast majority of jurisdictions. Second, even if this court were to hold that the Mathis standard is the law in Texas, the trial court correctly concluded that the circumstantial evidence of Shell's malicious evil intent was so weak as to amount to no evidence at all. And third, even if we adopt the Mathis standard and find that the circumstantial evidence was sufficient to prove intent, it is undisputed that there was no
relationship between that alleged intent and Shell's actual DTW prices. And 2305 is, after all, a pricing statute. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ronald J. Mann will present argument for respondents.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Can I just ask you that last statement he made?
Yes, I would be glad to.
Can you tie the price charge to the scheme to run them out of business?
Thank you, Justice Snyder. That's a very good question. And there's two things I'd like to say about the state of the record with respect to the second and third points that he just made. The second point that he made was a suggestion that the trial court found that even under the legal standard that we support, there's no evidence in the record. That's not correct. This is not a case where the people at trial filed a no evidence motion for summary judgment and the trial judge said whatever the duty might be, even if the duty is, as the plaintiffs assert, there's no evidence. And I would refer you specifically to the December 7th, 2000 hearing, pages 23 to 28, where the trial judge talks about this question. Generally, in that hearing, this is a hearing, not an order, because there's not a written opinion, the judge said, I'm willing to assume that there's enough evidence for you to make out these claims, but it's not going to matter to me because under my view of the law, what their intent was is not going to matter to me. So this is a case where the trial court said, you don't need to collect any more evidence, you don't need to prove anything more because the things that you're trying to prove are not going to convince me that you have a cause of action. And that's understandable, of course, because Mathis has not yet been decided. That answer is related to his third point, which is that it is undisputed, according to him, that there is no tie between the what you might say, the plan of Shell to alter the mix of distribution channels and its pricing policy. What is undisputed is that the record does not currently contain a document that proves that there was a tie. It's also undisputed, I think, that there are a variety of documents that might be relevant to that that we do not yet have. Just for example, at that same hearing, we discussed the fact that there are, based on things we've seen in other cases, 38 marketing plans that Shell has, and we've only gotten three of them in the record, and we'd like to see the other 35 to see what they say about that. More broadly, it cannot be the case that for us to approve what the intent of an entity like Shell was, that we would have to have a specific document that ties these things together. And I can talk more about that if that's important, but I thought what might be most useful is if I addressed three of the questions that the justices asked during the first argument.
Let me get you. Since you mentioned two of the three points, let me ask you about the first one. Do you agree that Shell's price, in effect, was an objectively, commercially reasonable price?
I do not. And I want to start by addressing your question, which might have been the very first question of the argument. He asked, does the standard of good faith, honesty in fact, include something that's subjective? And I'd like to refer you to this court's decision in the Lacerre-Grain case.
Test for good faith is actual belief of the party.
Yeah, that's what this court has said when they've addressed it. 673 Southwest 2nd 563, which I believe is the last time this court has interpreted the definition of good faith under the Uniform Commercial Code. You said quite firmly that it's a subjective standard. The Tom Lynn case on which he relies on a decision of the Supreme Court of Ohio, which takes a different view of whether it's subjective or objective. I think that's mostly not important for this particular case. I would characterize that as academic, which means it might be interesting to a law professor, but it's not really dispositive here.
Back to the objective, though. Your position is that the price doesn't meet even the objective part of the test.
Our position is that the standard of good faith requires both honesty in fact and commercial reasonableness. The objective part of the test would require them to have a commercially reasonable behavior. You can see easily.
The price in the abstract.
Well, of course, we're not challenging price in the abstract. Our contention is not that if we can prove that this price is too high that we win. Our contention is that the ultimate fact here, and this is relevant to their objective, the ultimate fact here is not, is this a high price? The thing that we have to prove is, They set this price for a bad reason.
All right, but I just want to be sure I'm clear on the first part, that you're not complaining that the price is not commercially reasonable.
We are not complaining that they set this price at a level that is commercially reasonable. Right. We believe that Section 2, if Comment 3 is going to influence your interpretation of the statute,
which it should,
then you should be reluctant to entertain claims where the ultimate fact for which someone should recover is that the price is too high or too low. But that, of course, is not our claim. Our claim is that this price was set for a motivation that is impermissible. And Shell does not contest the fact that the motivation we talk about is an impermissible motivation. They have not today, they haven't in their briefs, stood before you and said, we believe that under the general definition of good faith, it is just fine to operate in a way designed to destroy your contracting partner. And so from that, I want to talk about your question, which is what I thought was a perfect hypothetical, which is suppose that someone, that some group of refiners that has a large market share in a particular jurisdiction sets the price at $5 per gallon. Okay. Our position is, well, that's a breach of the contract. It may be that the federal government has some standard that might fix that for you. But what we're here today is to talk about a commercial law that governs contracts among businesses in the state of Texas. There are very good commercial reasons why people want to enter into contracts in which the price is not set at the time of the contract. That's why the Uniform Commercial Code says that you can do that. If this provision was not here, you would have one of two results. In an older 19th century era, you would have those contracts be held unenforceable. And that's bad for everybody. In the early part of the century, the relevant appellate cases from this state, you would have courts that would say, that's okay as long as the price is reasonable. The problem, generally, for businesses with a rule that prices have to be reasonable is that that means every case is an audit into the pricing structure of the seller. So the Uniform Commercial Code comes in and says, well, we're not going to say the prices have to be reasonable. We're going to say something which is much harder for a plaintiff to contest. We're going to say that the prices only have to be fixed in good faith. The price might seem reasonable, it might seem unreasonable, but if you can't prove that it's fixed in bad faith, you can't prevail.
But it's the troubling thing with that is if it's a reasonable price, what difference does it make whether the price setter is mean-spirited or cruel or vindictive or crazy or perfectly reasonable?
Well, I mean, that, of course, is the typical, you know, tension between a subjective and an objective component of a good faith standard, right? I mean, you have this concern that, well, why should it matter if something is done in a level that's not, that you can't prove is too high, but it's done for a bad reason. I think that that question, you know, to make you feel more comfortable about that, requires some thinking about something with which you're familiar, which is the general way that the concept of good faith has developed in the law, in the commercial law. What happens in the Uniform Commercial Code is there are, you know, generally, historically, two separate standards for good faith. There's a standard that requires only honesty in fact, which is generally regarded as being a harder standard to be satisfied, and a standard that requires both honesty in fact and commercial reasonableness. That standard is generally regarded as being, you know, more onerous because businesses are subject to two different methods of proof that can be used to challenge them. And so that standard applies only to merchants in Article 2. And in the original version of the UCC, did not really apply in most of the other articles. The point is that there are two different things that you can prove. If someone can prove that the reason the price is set is for this particularly bad motive and can convince a fact finder of that because they have, you know, adequate evidence of that, that strikes me as it's something that the commercial law should not tolerate. It is, of course, the case, and I think here that it's easy to think about employment litigation, that if they can come in and say, look, the price we are charging is precisely equal to, you know, the other price that we charge for another distribution channel plus these costs, and here's how we come up with the price. Or we charge this price because this is the way calculated for us to make the highest amount of profit out of this distribution channel. Our goal is to make money. If they come into the trial court and say, we're setting the price at the level that gets us the highest possible profit, and they have an explanation for that, well, I think we lose. Our position is that if there was a trial on that, they couldn't prove that.
But it's hard to understand why you should win just because they say, well, we did all that. All that's true. But in addition, we hate these particularly lease dealers.
Well, those mixed motive cases, are always going to be complicated. You can, I refer to employment discrimination, which is what I'm talking about. Imagine a case where you have an employer who, you know, has, you know, some entrance exam for getting a particular position, and you might believe that the reason they had this entrance exam is because they want to keep minorities from being hired. You know, they say, well, we have it because we want qualified employees. You can have cases where it's going to be difficult to know what the motivation is, but if you can actually prove that the motivation is that the purpose was to eliminate employees, was to eliminate minorities, and if that's an illegitimate motivation as a matter of contract law, then even if it turns out that the test was reasonable, well, that, you know, that, that you can't prove that the test was unreasonable, then the plaintiff can prevail. What that means in the real world, of course, is that the test probably is unreasonable. If you adopted the test and it can be proved that you adopted it for the purpose of excluding minorities, it may be that the test is in fact unreasonable, but that's just harder to prove.
Professor, let me ask you a specific example. I understand there was some expert testimony that the price in the Exxon case in Mathis, the DTW price, was higher than the rack price because it reflected the investment in land, the store, the transportation, cost of managers, et cetera. The expert, Michael Keeley, I think, testified to that, according to the published opinion in Mathis' case. Does what you're arguing require, under similar circumstances as in this case, the seller to price its gas lower than its cost?
Not at all. Not at all. Can I address what our theory of the factual proof is?
Briefly.
Okay. Our premises, and I think that when you read their briefs, there's a lot of confusion between things that we regard as evidence and things we regard as the ultimate fact. There are many things that are evidence because they would be probative of the ultimate fact. But for us, the ultimate fact is that we need to prove, that we would like a chance to prove, is that Shell set these prices with the intention of driving our clients out of business. Now, if we had evidence that showed how the rack price was calculated, and if we had evidence that showed the components of that price, if we had evidence that showed the components of the price that's charged to our client, so if we knew, for example, how much it actually costs for transportation and the other services that are provided to our clients, which are substantial services for which Shell should charge our clients. If we knew those various things, suppose that it turns out that the rack price is, you know, $1.50 a gallon, and that the services that are provided to our clients are roughly 27 cents a gallon, and that the price charged to our client is $5 a gallon, which is just a spill type hypothetical. I think that is evidence that tends to establish, doesn't prove, but it's evidence that would tend to establish the fact that we're trying to prove. If you also had evidence that said
That example is the converse of my example.
Right. So I think if you had evidence that the price was lower, I think that would be evidence that would tend to rebut the fact that we wish to prove. But there's all sorts of other evidence that would rebut the fact that we wish to prove. Because in the market, of course, the price to our clients is going to be higher than the rack price.
So you think it's a fact question that the jury should decide?
Absolutely. But let me, to clarify, because I don't want you to be misled to say that to think that the only way refiners can respond to our case is by charging a cost-losing price. Another way that they can respond to our case is by explaining to the trial court their pricing structure in a way that shows that it's perfectly reasonable. Or standing pat and saying, you just can't prove this because no one would believe based on what you have.
It's your contention that you had enough proof in this record to get to trial.
I think that's right.
And you're not complaining of trial judge abuse of discretion in not giving you additional discovery. I mean, you're complaining, you whine about it, but it's not a point that you're asking the court to reverse on.
I would characterize whine and complain as judgmental terms.
I'm sorry, I don't want to be judgmental.
That's okay.
There's no point of error on that.
I have children, I'm frequently judgmental. What I would say is the way in which the trial court handled discovery reflected the trial court's understanding of the law and reflected an intention to resolve a case in accordance with the trial court's understanding of the law in an expeditious manner, which is what trial courts are supposed to do. I'm not complaining about the discovery because I don't think that the trial court's discovery practices are before you for review because the Court of Appeals did not resolve them.
But
what I think is before you is the state of the record as it was decided.
And you're saying there's enough evidence here that you raised a fact issue on this point if we agree with your view of what the law is on this section of the UCC?
Yes, I have two things I would say on that. One, let me say structure what they are, then say two things about them. The first one is, yes, our position is that the evidence that's in the record right now is enough to get past summary judgment. Second, procedurally, because of the way the case was handled in the trial court, we don't believe that the case is yet ripe for disposition on summary judgment because the trial court's determination as to what evidence we could acquire through the discovery process depended, properly, I would say, on the trial court's understanding of the applicable law.
What are you asking us to do about that? Reverse in the interest of justice?
No.
For more discovery?
I'm asking you to affirm.
Well, affirm. Yes, sir.
I'm asking you to affirm. What the Court of Appeals said
to
is...
Affirm because... Yeah, all right.
Yeah. What the Court of Appeals said is, here's our view of the law. We believe the trial court, which did not have the benefit of Judge Smith's opinion in Mathis, got the law wrong. We're going to send this back. We assume that when the trial court examines the motion for summary judgment, the trial court will deal with these discovery issues in a way that's appropriate with the accurate legal standards. These are, frankly, things that are difficult for appellate courts to deal with.
If a refiner were charging you $5 a gallon with this bad intent, what various causes of action would you have?
I think if that's the only facts that we could establish, that
$5 to drive you out of business.
Right. If the facts that I have are a document that demonstrates at the relevant level of the selling entity that the entity intended, and obviously it's complicated to know what it means for Shell to intend anything, but if I could demonstrate that the entity set the price with the intention to drive my customer out of business, it's not immediately clear to me that breach of contract action wouldn't be the best cause of action. I can't bring that's not something that I like to say.
Is there anything else in the dealership agreement that you could sue on other than this clause about price setting? Is there something within the whole agreement? The number of terms, each party using best efforts to help each other, anything like that?
I don't think so, but that goes to the traditional understanding of good faith, the way that people try to accommodate the concern that a duty of good faith would be vague is to have the judges and the appellate courts articulate the types of motivations that are impermissible. I mean, that's the distinction between the law and the facts. And the law would be, in our view, it is not consistent with the duty of good faith to act with the intention to destroy your contracting partner. The facts are that you have to prove that. The way, sort of the test by which we say that violates good faith is, well, that's not something that could possibly have been in the reasonable contemplation of the parties. And the reason you can see that is, imagine that if the contracts with dealers said, Section 14, Shell shall be free to set prices in a way designed to cause all of its dealers to file for bankruptcy. Okay, that's not, the dealers would have objected to that, presumably, and certainly would not have thought that that was what the deal was in the contract. So the duty of good faith is to reflect these types of things that couldn't possibly be thought to be commercially justifiable.
But as you stand here now, you don't know of any other thing in the dealer refiner contract that you would have good faith implied into, apart from the price provision.
This case, we do not rely at all on any implied duty of good faith. We rely entirely on... The reason I'm reluctant, it sounds like I'm being evasive. I'm not being evasive because I don't want to say yes. I'm being evasive because I want to be precise. This is not a complaint about the price. This goes back to the discussion of Nana Cooley. This is not a complaint about the price. This is a complaint about the way in which the price was set.
Well, let me try this a different way. Rather than digging through the record, I was trying to take a short one.
I like to be responsive.
The petitioner says that initially you brought a whole lot of causes of action, and it's been whittled down. It's down to this. So what other causes of action were at one time in this litigation anymore?
Frankly, Your Honor, that's true. And frankly, I couldn't tell you all of them. I mean, there certainly was one under the Petroleum Marketing Protects the PMPA, which is a federal statute that generally says that they cannot intentionally terminate dealers. That cause of action is very difficult to prove in the Fifth Circuit because there's no cause of action for constructive termination. There's an Abrams Shell case from the Fifth Circuit, won by this very talented lawyer here.
But let me ask you, just to put a very fine point on it, you get a memo from whoever sets prices at Shell, and it says, we're going to charge this DTW price. It may have the effect of driving
lessee dealers out of business, comma, unfortunately. Do you win that case with that memo or lose it?
I think that if you have that memo, it would be relevant evidence, and I think that it's highly likely that George Fleming would stand up for the plaintiffs and try to convince the jury that was really bad. And I think
even the unfortunate.
I think he would say the memo shows that they had the intention to do this. When you look at this, I suspect that a lawyer for Shell would argue with considerable force, well, the unfortunate part shows that we didn't really want to do that. And I think a fact finder would have to decide what the actual intent is, because we don't. Yeah, we obviously can make our case out without such a memo at all.
Add the fact that Shell's price is the lowest price in the industry to that hypothesis.
I think it'd be.
Summary judgment against you or not?
That's a difficult question because it deals with.
Yes, I know. I want your opinion on it.
Frankly, if I was a trial judge, I would be predisposed to grant summary judgment on that. And the reason, can I say what we want?
Yes.
The reason is because it's difficult to decide whether circumstances in which you want to have evidence weighed in the context of a summary judgment motion, because you could take a formalistic view that says we've produced enough evidence to get to the 30-yard line, and that's enough to have a jury trial. And so any evidence they introduce, well, that's just evidence that the jury has to weigh. So you shouldn't stop a trial just because they have some really killer defensive evidence. My perspective is, if you know going in, because of something that the defendant has produced, that no jury could possibly decide that, well, I'm inclined to think that.
So then there are circumstances, from your standpoint, and your approach, under which the price alone is sufficient to satisfy 305.
What I'm saying is I think that you could introduce evidence.
Is that correct or incorrect?
Not technically. I think it's not technically.
Well, you said yes in answer to my hypothetical.
I did, but I think your hypothetical is worded slightly differently than your question. I don't like to be obstructive.
Well, my hypothetical was one example of when the price alone was sufficient for Shell to win. Even given the equivocal statement in the memo about putting dealers out of business. Correct? That was one example.
My perspective, yes.
So then there are circumstances, even from your standpoint, where price alone is sufficient for Shell to win under 2.305. Because there's one counterexample.
In the interest of sitting down, I would say yes, depending on the nature of the proof that the plaintiffs have introduced themselves. And the hypothetical is one in which the plaintiffs have not introduced evidence that would justify a jury in contradicting that particular piece of evidence.
Sure. The hypothetical assumes facts.
Right.
We're basing the questions on those assumed facts.
Forgive me for coming back to the other causes of action. It's not just in the interest of knowing the whole lawsuit, which I don't want to know, but it's in the interest of knowing how much the drafters of the UCC and the legislature intended for this particular provision to bear in terms of what other legal remedies theories are out there for really bad behavior by a seller who has the power to set a price.
Well, I think conceptually you start off the idea that you're going to try and find a statute that regulates the industry, you're going to try and find a tort cause of action, a contract cause of action. Looking at tort cause of action, I think you would immediately say, I should sue these people for breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. You'd say, well, I live in Texas, and we don't have implied duty of good faith and fair dealing because we think that puts too much authority over lawmaking in the hands of the judiciary. We think that the legislature should decide when people are subject to duty of good faith. Then I go to contract cause of action and I say, okay, well, this one actually looks good because the particular price in this case is set with reference to a particular UCC provision that, with plain intent, said that a duty of good faith applies. And so I would say, well, this one actually looks really good. I would look for regulatory statutes, the major regulatory statutes at the federal level, it's the Petroleum Marketing Protections Act. My sense is the law is not entirely clear that our cause of action wouldn't prevail there for constructive termination. My sense is that that's a very tough argument in the Fifth Circuit right now because there's a recent Fifth Circuit case that says that cause of action is
an antitrust, state or federal, requires some proof that Shell has been dealing with somebody else.
I'm not an antitrust expert, but the main things for antitrust law you would think about would be monopolization or conspiracy. Now, I can't imagine that the facts we have here would suffice any sort of claim for a monopolization. As far as conspiracy among refiners, a number of you have asked questions that might support a cause of action on that. And antitrust litigation is very complicated, and there would be a lot of things we would have to prove to prevail on such a cause of action that wouldn't really be relevant as a policy matter to what's objected to here. Because what's objected to here is just a basic contract principle. The only reason that the UCC can make these contracts enforceable is, and this is the part that Carl Llewellyn wrote in the earliest drafts of the covenant, is you have to reject this uncommercial idea that what the parties mean when they say the seller can set the price is that the seller can do absolutely anything the seller wants. And there has to be some constraint, and the constraint they picked was the narrowest one they could think of, which is good faith.
Is the Mathis construction, in your view, the majority view on 2305, or a minority, or are there enough cases for us to make
it's certainly not a minority view, but that's because there are very few cases that have analyzed 2305 comment 3. What you would say, and when you say the Mathis view, you mean like, well, you could take it at different levels. What you can say is there are several federal courts of appeals that have considered the question whether 2305(2) permits a cause of action when the refiner can prove that it's charging the same thing as its competitors. And every federal court of appeals, when the seller can do that, every federal court of appeals that has looked at that has said, yes, you can maintain that cause of action. And that would be the Fifth Circuit in Mathis, opinion by Judge Smith, the Ninth Circuit in Anacooley, with concurrence by then Judge Kennedy. The 11th Circuit implicitly in Alapata, they say almost nothing, but they're affirming a district court opinion. The 10th Circuit in Wayman, where they affirm for the reasons stated in a district court opinion that says that. And then the 6th Circuit in Tom Lynn. I mean, remember, if you read the 6th Circuit opinion in Tom Lynn, what it says is the standard has to be wholly objective, and then it engages in this long question of, is it, as an objective matter, commercially unjustifiable to drive people out of business, and they evaluate the record. This is why when you ask me what does it mean to be commercially justifiable, commercially reasonable, if it's an objective standard, if you wanted to take Texas good faith law and say, well, it's wholly objective as in Ohio, it wouldn't change the litigation that much. It would just change whether the proof had to be that Shell actually intended to do this, as opposed to whether the proof had to be that it was commercially unjustifiable as an objective matter for Shell to do this. And that's not that different as a matter of proof. It's, you know, important academically, but I don't think it would change the case. So.
Any other questions? Thank you. Your Honors, in the final analysis, we are dealing with the Uniform Commercial Code. The purpose of the code is to promote commerce through a uniform set of laws. The purpose of Section 2305 is to eliminate, not create, legal disputes. I respectfully submit that what I have just heard is a recipe for perpetual litigation. I note the portion of Exxon's amicus brief in which they point out that some of the very same dealers who were plaintiffs in the Mathis case have sued them again for all the gasoline that they bought since the judgment in that case. The Mathis standard undermines contractual certainty. A refiner has absolutely no idea how to set a good faith price because, after all, it's subjective. A refiner can be sued years after a transaction to renegotiate a price that the parties agreed upon at the outset.
Well, these contracts by their very nature are the antithesis of contractual certainty.
Well, at the outset, Your Honor, the dealer agrees, because of the volatility of oil prices, to leave the pricing in the refiner's hands,
right, look to any other benchmark, because there are plenty of benchmarks in this industry.
Subject to the requirements that the price has to be in a range with the dealer prices of the major competitors, and there cannot be price discrimination among dealers in the same pricing zone. And that is what the founders, the drafters intended. In return for that, the dealer is entitled to all sorts of support. The refiner buys the land, builds the station, provides advertising, accounting, credit, marketing support. So these parties have an opportunity at the initiation of the contract to balance the rewards and the risks. Right now, if the Mathis case remains the law, Texas is absolutely isolated, and the code is no longer uniform in a very important sense.
What did Lucera mean? What was Lucera grain? Just a little loose language? Or?
I don't think that it was intended to apply to a situation such as this when wherein the drafters of the very section have told us explicitly what the section should mean and what it must mean if we're going to have commercial transactions under open price terms.
So comment three sort of is intended to trump the general definition of good faith.
Your Honor, I have always looked at comment three as a guide to what the drafters' motives were. That, to me, seems to be the importance of comment three. It tells us what they were thinking. In addition to producing a flood of litigation if the Mathis case becomes the law, and I think that the excellent amicus briefs of British Petroleum and ExxonMobil, and I hope our brief on the merits indicates the proliferation of litigation under this Mathis rule. And you already see courts stepping away from Texas and pointing out that the Texas law is isolated. Can't miss that comment in the Tom Lynn decision, basically saying that this is not the law up here or anywhere else that we know of. I see my time's
up. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause and in the causes submitted today. Marshall will adjourn the court.
All rise. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.